Hello and welcome to another episode of the Menswear Style Podcast. I'm your host, Pete Brooker. Today I'm talking to Jeff Suster, who is the managing director of Suster & Hicks. That is susterandhicks.com is where you can find out more information. I'm just going to give you a little thumbnail sketch because I've got to tell you, I've just got off the phone to Jeff. We spoke for about an hour and a half. I think you're going to have one of the best times on this podcast listening to Jeff than you have had for quite a while. Jeff has had a career spanned over 50 years, hand-cutting more than 30,000 bespoke suits. He was elected as the youngest ever national president of the Federation of Merchant Tailors in 1988, and also works as a consultant helping to set up and improve the patterns created for made-to-measure manufacturers such as Wensum. Okay, that is all I'm going to give you. The rest you're going to find out yourself, and here is Jeff to tell you more.
Okay, so I've been in the trade now. In fact, next month will be 55 years as a bespoke tailor, cutter more than anything else. And I got into the trade back in 1966. Let's just say I had a checkered school career. Most of my family were teachers. My sister was, my cousins, my uncles, my aunts, and all the family were teachers. And I, in fact, wanted to be a teacher. I love sports. I wanted to be a sportsmaster, but it didn't turn out that way. I used to get bored in the class and I used to play around. Nothing aggressive, but I got kicked out of the local grammar school, then went to a second school and only lasted 2 months there. Basically, because the music master wanted me, I'm 15 years old at that time, and the music master wanted me to sing Three Blind Mice. He knew I could play pianoforte. He knew I sang on a church choir, but he was just taking belittling me. I wouldn't sing it, so he took me to the headmaster. In those days, you'd get six of the best, and it obviously wasn't going to work. My uncle, incidentally, was head of maths at this particular school, so a bit embarrassing. But I asked if I was old enough to leave the school, and they said yes. So I left some expletives, which I shouldn't have done, but that's what I was like, and that's what I felt like. Uh-huh. And I got on my bike to go home and then tell my mum and dad I've just come out of the second school in 3 months. Not funny. On the way home to where I lived, there was bespoke tailors on the corner of the road, and going back, tracking slightly, my cousin worked in the trade and was a salesman, a front man in the shop. Wasn't a cutter, wasn't a tailor. And I used to go down and see him sometimes on Saturdays when I wasn't at school and look at the cloths and he'd explain the latest styles. And in the 60s, everybody was into suits, and particularly mohair suits, mod boy era, which was me personified. And I was interested in it. And funny enough, he asked me, he said, what are you going to do if you don't get on at school, the second school? I said, I don't know, maybe I'll come and sell suits. And he said to me, in fact, at the time, it didn't register at all. But he said to me, actually, he's 5 years old. He said, actually, I wish I'd have learned how to make them. I wish I was a tailor. I'd love to have made them. I didn't even really honestly pick up on that conversation. I really didn't. Right. But on my way home from school, I'm going past this tailor, and I'm thinking, I've got to get back to my mum and dad and give them good news and bad news. So I got off the bike, walked into the little tailor's, Jewish man, as many people were in our trade back in that time. Lovely fella called Lou. And I asked him if he could give me a job as a tailor. He said, are you really interested? I thought, yeah, I'm very interested. I'm in trouble. He didn't know that. And he couldn't take me on. He's too small. So he phoned the biggest firm up then in Lewiston, my hometown, a company called W. Bell & Son. And I got an appointment the following morning at 8 o'clock to be interviewed to become an apprentice tailor.
Wow.
I went home and told my parents what had happened. They weren't happy with the way I'd been treated at school and actually sort of chosen and obviously what was going on. They weren't happy with the language I used either, but in case of why that was then. I went for the job interview at 8 o'clock that following morning at W. Bell & Son, and the gentleman asked me about how interested I was. I said, well, I love suits, I love fashion, I want to give it a go, I'd love to try. He said, well, when can you start? So I said, well, I've left school, you can put that inverted commas, obviously. So I can start whenever you want to. He said, well, what are you doing today? So I said, well, I've just come down to have an interview. He said, what, do you want to start today? So I said, well, what now? So he said, yeah, well, I've got nothing to do. So I literally started on that morning.
Wow, that is amazing.
55 years later, I'm still doing it.
Oh, terrific. And may I ask what's happened to the tailor that you started with?
Lou died many years ago. He used to live, obviously, near to where I used to live. His little shop was in those days, back in my old town of Luton, it would be the same everywhere. There was at least 30 bespoke tailors in that town.
Wow.
Because everybody had their suits made. Ready to wear was not what you think it is like it is now. There wasn't the choice. And actually, if you're quite honest, it wasn't very good either. Right. It wasn't until you got to the late 70s or 80s that ready-to-wear suddenly had manufacturers, German houses, Italian, you know, the usual names that you probably still know some of them now, that started to produce a good quality ready-to-wear suit. And then it was competition for the tailors.
I didn't know Luton was so synonymous with tailors. I knew it was a millinery town.
It's not actually synonymous with tailors. It just was the same in every town you went to. It's a big town, Luton. You know, it's 150,000 people. Even in Woburn, in this village that I'm living in now, this lovely village here in Bedfordshire, it's only a very small high street. There's only 1,000 people live in the village. Obviously, everybody knows it because of the safari park and the Woburn Abbey itself, the stately manor, and then, of course, the golf course. But I've gone back into the history. There's a lovely little museum in here, one of the old churches, and there were 6 bespoke tailors on the high street back in Victorian times.
Wow.
Because everybody had a suit made, and that's the way it was. So Luton was, you're quite correct, Luton was hats. My mother was millinery. My sister was very good at embroidery and things like this as well. But there was nobody in my family that was in tailoring at all. I just, you could say, fell into it. So I did a 5-year apprenticeship as a bespoke tailor at that firm. Unfortunately, the firm, the guy that was running the firm, it's called W. Bell & Son, and the firm was a great firm, but the guy that bought the bells out, they wanted to retire, was a cutter. Rather like I am now, a bespoke tailor's cutter, but he wasn't a businessman and he was losing the business. Eventually, the business got sold out to somebody else in Hertfordshire. I won't mention his name because it's not right to do so. And he took the business over and then sacked everybody in the workroom because he wanted all the stuff made in the East End of London on the cheap. And I had Italian tailors that were teaching me here because the Italians have always been renowned for tailoring, of course, as you know. I ended up at the London College of Fashion on a day release course where I actually did the first time I started doing cutting.
Okay.
In fact, the cutting side of it with the day release, I remember I was annoyed because I just wanted to learn how to finish making trousers, how to make waistcoats. I didn't want to do the cutting. I wanted to get more tailoring. And I was annoyed because I had to do the course came at the London College of Fashion only with the cutting in the morning, tailoring in the afternoon. At the end of the year, we had the exams done on everything we've been learning, and at the end of it we had the exams done. I came second in the class on the cutting out of 32. It didn't mean nothing to me because I wasn't interested in it, and I went to walk out the door and the lecturer called me back. He said, "Jeff, come here." So I said, "What?" He said, "What are you doing?" So I said, "What do you mean, what am I doing? I'm on my tailoring apprenticeship." He said, "You know you came second." So I said, "Yeah, I know I came second." So he said, "You didn't even try, did you?" So I said, "No, I want to be a tailor." And he said to me, "You listen to me, my boy. You want to be a cutter. The cutter employs a tailor. The tailor can make a beautiful jacket, but if it doesn't fit, it's no bloody good. So go and get yourself taught as a cutter if you can." And that's how I fell into that as well.
Would you say you took to it, Jeff? Or was it just all the training? I mean, not everybody does the school and the apprenticeship and the 5 years. Was it something you really grafted at?
Yeah, because the money was crap. Basically, hairdressing and tailoring and a rag trade, as it's known affectionately, was probably the worst money. But I survived. I loved it. I did it. I survived. It was hard. My parents were behind us. They didn't take any keep off me because I hadn't got enough bloody money. But I did it. And altogether, it took me about 8.5 years for doing the tailoring apprenticeship and also doing the cutting. I worked for a firm called Kilgour French and Stanbury. They're now just called Kilgour. I did part of my apprenticeship there under Louis Stanbury, one of the main guys, obviously the name of the company. And I worked learning some of the tailoring I did under an Italian tailor called Salvador. And I was working in one of the offices around the corner from Savaro in Warwick Street next to Dorme, the cloth people. They had a big showroom there. And a big office floor full of tailors that were making for all the different Savaro tailors around that area. That's how it was. That's how it still is to a degree, but we can come on to that later if you wish.
Sure. Did you live in London at any point, or were you always...
No. I'm born and bred in Luton. Not many people own up coming from Luton, but it's my old town. There's good and bad in every town, but it's my old town. As you said earlier, it was known for hats. Known for manufacturing as well. There were big manufacturers and ladies' fashions and ladies' manufacturing, which my wife, Laura, also learned as a dressmaker and machinist and overlooker. So she was very skilled at that sort of thing.
And so... I don't want to kind of fast forward through 3 decades, but the business as it is today, Jeff, perhaps you can talk about the family business. So you have a couple of elder sons and a daughter-in-law. Do you mind just tapping on that?
Yeah, of course. So now, with my wife, Laura, we started a business in 1978, so it's 43 years now we've had our business, from very, very small to bigger to smaller. In the years of 40 years, things change. And my elder son, Scott, joined us just under 25 years ago. My younger son, Scott Wes, joined us 19 years ago. And I've trained both of those to become bespoke tailors cutters. So they can both cut and fit. Wes can actually make fittings. Scott can actually do some sewing, but he's not really tailoring. He's more involved in the sales and fitting with the customers and that side of the business. So I taught both of them. My daughter-in-law, which is Scott's wife, which is Natalie, she works in the family business with us. She looks after the ladies' tailoring side with my wife, Laura, and also I've helped her and taught her how to run the company on the management side and business and account side. So she does that. Wesley's future wife, should have been wife by now, but with COVID, they couldn't get married last year or this. Daisy, she looks after the social media and everything on our side of the business as well. So the whole family's involved. And on top of that, I have two girls in the workroom who I've trained from school. One left to have children, the other one didn't. But Jane, that didn't leave, she'd started the horses, never had any children. She's now been moving for 41 years. She does our hand sewing and pressing. And Bubs, whose real name is Leslie, but it's always a bubbly personality, so she's nicknamed as Bubs. She does all the flatbed machining, and she's excellent at doing things like that. So that's what she does.
Right, that's fascinating. That is a very close-knit relationship in terms of family, work. I mean, we just spoke offline about how I kind of had a similar background with my dad and my brothers and working for the family business. What I learned from my upbringing is that you kind of enjoyed the highs and lows of everything within small business over the years, over the decades, through different governments, through different economic crisis. It kind of everything that happens at work seems to happen at home simultaneously. And
a family business, you're so right, and it does. I'm afraid you can't just turn the button off and say, well, we're not talking about it now. It's tough. When it's right, it's brilliant. When it's wrong, it's not funny. I mean, I lost my business in 1992. Laura and I lost our business in 92 with a recession. Long story that, but we lost everything. We had to start all over again. I was 40 years old. But I didn't lose my customers and I didn't lose my reputation. We were on the high street, stuck with personal guaranteed leases. One of my shops had a shop in Dunstable. They put the rent up by 137%. And that's not a misquote. That is what they tried to put the rent up by and could, because somebody had paid that rent on the high street. And it was a four-year review and they nearly tripled my rent. And I personally guaranteed it, which I didn't know, but fault of my solicitor, which I proved was incompetent. But I was statutory barred. I couldn't sue him because it was after 6 years that I found out. So in anybody in business, you're very lucky if you can be in business for as long as 40 years and not have a hiccup. We had a big hiccup. I didn't end up personally bankrupt. Probably would have been cheaper if I had been, but my companies were lost. But we started back up again in a very small way. Somebody helped us and we built it back up again. And then I learned, as you do in life, you learn, I'm not going to make that same mistake again. So now we bought the freehold here in Woburn. We own the shop, we own the flat above, we own the land at the back. And so we don't have to worry about, I'm my own landlord, it's my pension. So we don't have to worry about landlords probably doing what they did to me before.
Right. I mean, it sounds like that's a great place you're in. I mean, I know that you have kind of Brexit and COVID and everything else, lockdowns going on the periphery, but are you happy within yourself that the business is under your own control, under your own sovereignty?
Yeah, absolutely right. And the thing that's changing, obviously, with fashion. I mean, before COVID, we had started to change the picture and the offer that we were giving to people to come to us because we were doing far more casual things. And obviously with COVID and people working from home and the more dressing down or more smart business or whichever way you want to call it, we were already beginning to focus on that. And luckily we've been in the period of time over the last 18 months, we've using a couple of factories now for our lower end, our entry level black label, where we are now making everything that anybody wants to wear. So we're now, I never thought I'd be doing this. Besides making our handmade suits, which we can talk about later if you wish, we're now making everything from jackets, from unconstructed jackets, obviously unlined. We're making knitwear made to measure. We're making quilted jackets. We're making bomber jackets. We're making jeans, chinos made to measure, shoes, trainers, everything. The whole picture is incredible.
Wow.
And the younger generation, my sons decided that we've got to change the image of the whole shop. There's three showrooms in our shop. On the ground floor now, they're quite modern. The lounges, they've got instead of having cutting boards, they now have counters. They've got high chairs. We've got gin on the side. We have gin and tonic. Have a beer. You can have a lovely coffee. All Bedfordshire gin. Bedfordshire people getting the coffee companies. We would like to try and keep the business locally. And it's a different feel to the whole thing. My room upstairs in the shop is still very tailoring. You know, it's still very traditional. You see all the patterns hanging up and all the cloth everywhere. It's tidier than most bespoke tailor showrooms. But it's that. So we now cover everything because the customers, and this is the thing that people don't understand. So the youngest customers we get are probably mid-20s to mid to late-20s, and it's weddings that brings them in.
Right.
And also once they've learned, they've all been branded, they've all been sold for 20 years about having brands, and in the end they suddenly find out that we can do a made-to-measure suit for them for less, or the same price or less than what they're paying for a good quality ready-to-wear labeled suit. And they can have it individually designed and make it fit by using computer cutting systems and using factories all over the world, which is what we do.
Right. It must be quite gratifying to kind of school people at the same time, because I mean, I imagine like I was when I was in my 20s, everything was the casual game. Everything was,
of course,
jeans and tees. But then once you start to learn a thing or two and you realize there's a little bit more outside of your, you know, your kind of high street ready to wear £99 two piece, and it kind of opens up a new world. And so for you to kind of be there on the precipice of that must be quite nice.
Yeah, I mean, the funny thing about being a bespoke tailor, if I go back, sorry, I won't go back too many times, because unfortunately, at my age, at 70, you do tend to talk about then. But in 1981, 1982, I had a double-page spread done on me in what was then the Menswear magazine, because we, as a bespoke tailor, were expanding and twice the size of the shop, and then had two shops from nothing, because we'd bought in a lot of ready-to-wear. And we were the first sort of independent bespoke tailor, and I do mean a proper bespoke tailor, not somebody sending stuff away to factories to cut. We were the first ones in the country to do that. And double page spread, all that did was got every rep and every agent from every ready-to-wear company trying to get their products into our shop. So we did for many years. We were extremely successful on ready-to-wear. But we'd started to get our ready-to-wear over the last 5 years anyway. We used to sell the Barber, Eaton shirts. I sold Eaton shirts for 40 years, Barker shoes, Cardia jeans, Hilltool jeans, labels. But not the Armani, that kind of thing, but something a little bit underneath that. We used to sell that all the time, but we don't sell it now. Everything we make. So it's turned completely full circle from being the first bespoke tailor that actually started doing all that ready-to-wear. Now I don't do any of it. And it's like, in Savareau, they're only just thinking, oh, we ought to do a bit of ready-to-wear, and they get a few shirts and ties, and they don't seem to understand that's not really what people are looking for.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Jeff, I'm curious to know on the website, which everyone can look at, by the way, SousterandHicks.com. We'll leave all the links over on the show notes. It's a great place to hang out, and especially the client list and the history of the shop. But it says that you've cut circa 30,000 bespoke suits. So
yeah,
I'm curious, over that time, have you developed a house style, a favorite style? Maybe it came on early, maybe it was within the first thousand, and but has it changed over the years?
Well, obviously fashion has changed over the year, but as far as a house style is concerned, or the cut, basically, yeah, the cut is very Savareau. I was trained, well, I did part of the story earlier, I said about I was being taught, I had to learn how to become a bespoke tailor's cutter. A gentleman that taught me was a fellow called John Carter. He died a few years ago, but he was one in his 80s. He was also, as it happened, trained and actually worked for Kilgour's, or Kilgour Francis Danbury, as it originally was. And he taught me the Savareau cut, which was a very high-fitting armhole, a nicely shaped jacket, slightly flared. And there's that look to it, which actually is not that different from the Italian look. I don't mean the silly stuff now where they're so short and everything's too tight. I mean the traditional tailored look. And I've been to factories all over Europe. The Germans cut a big baggy job like the old Hugo Boss stuff used to be, with baggy armholes. I haven't got a clue how to make a suit fit. But the Italians know how to do it, and so do we. And when I speak to the Italian factories, when I've been to, I went to a lovely factory called Caruso in Italy a few years ago, got on with them, great, lovely product, lovely people, 4,000 people then working there, I don't know about now. And they were saying, oh, yeah, but we do this, we're better than Savareau. But the Savareau guys I know will say they're better than the Italians. And actually, the truth is, they're as good as each other. And the books and the way they work of how to make a suit feel comfortable and how it fits are the same. It's the same. It's the same principle. So we have I designed a 5-button angle cuff. So a traditional bespoke suit would have 4 buttons on the cuff. The bottom 2 buttonholes would undo. Army surgeon's cuffs, or surgeon's cuffs as they're called. And with one of my customers about 12 years ago, who was a bit of a character, and we called him Bling Meister because he had bling everywhere. John, if he ever sees this, wouldn't mind me saying that, because that's what he's known for. Come on, Jeff, let's do a different cuff. And we designed an angle going across the cuff with 5 buttons coming down the side. And now we've developed on that, because the little inset in the corner of the cuff, you can see it on the website, you can then put contrasting cloth in there. So I designed that, as I say, about 12 years ago. With a lapel, I use a lapel quite often. You have basically, other than dress wear, when you have a shawl collar, you have normally 2 different styles of lapels you can buy off the peg. You probably know, Pete. you've got a normal notch lapel, or you have the peak lapel, which is the double breasted lapel, but it can be put on a single breasted jacket. In between that is what we call a fish mouth lapel. And this is something I didn't design, but actually I've got an old picture up here of the Rat Pack and Sinatra and the boys. And they used to wear quite a slim lapel, and it's a fish mouth lapel. So basically, the notch where you get the square, where your collar comes down, then you've got the top of the lapel, is closer together like a little fish's mouth. So we do that a lot. Now, that's not my – I didn't design that. I didn't think of that. Somebody else did it before me. We've been making down suits now, haven't we, for 120 years. So everything's been done before, no matter what you want to think. Other than the five-button cuff, that generally was something I designed. Whether something else had been done to do with military or something – 100, 200 years ago, I don't know, but I don't think so. So there's a look to it, and you can always tell by our cut, by the shape and the jacket and the way it's done, because it's a traditional Savoy cut. And now, of course, we have to cut them a bit shorter because that's the fashion. The trousers, obviously, are so tight and so narrow and so skinny, which back in the early 60s were called drain pipes, and the jackets being so short, Italian style, and the jackets were not being crew, but were called bum freezers, and that's what they were. And it's the same style as it was then. It all comes from 60 years ago, same style. The kids come in now thinking it's a new style. Say, hang on a minute, they did this 60 years ago.
Yeah.
There's a lovely book, I think, but you must have seen it. I mean, you don't have to plug that necessarily. There's a book of Sharp Suits. You think you probably know the journalist who is a good friend of mine who's actually written that book, and he's taught the history going back from the 1910, 20, 30, 40, 60, all the way through.
Is that Eric Musgrave?
Yes, Eric, yeah. Who did very well on Millionaire, didn't he? He won a bit of money on The Millionaire. So he's done very well. In fact, I'm sitting there thinking, oh, bloody hell, Eric's on. Oh, he's a fabulous journalist, a lovely book. And it shows all that. Actually, I bring that book out to people. And they say about styles. I mean, even going back to like zoot suit styles. Do you know what a zoot suit is, Pete?
When I hear the word zoot suit, I think 1920s, kind of gangsters. Am I in the right area?
Yeah, it could be that area. But obviously, it was no more recently, you go back to the 80s with Kid Creole and the Coconut. He used to wear the very high-fitting trousers, very baggy
right
at the top. And then the bottoms of the trousers were very narrow. The jacket was very long, almost to the quarter length. That was an American style as well. But actually, the trouser style came from the West Indies. Huh. And nearly everything you have on style. So although we design suits to make things look a bit more exclusive for us, for our looks, other people say that's a Suitstone Hicks suit. Lots of the things that you have on suits are there for practicalities. Mm. The reason why they had in the West Indies, they had this big baggy trouser at the top, and the bottom on the foot was very, very narrow. And so the trousers were really like a bow shape. And I remember there was a lot of West Indian customers back in the 60s and 70s. And I've still got a few now. And what's the idea with these bottoms? He said, Jeff, you've been to the West Indies? It's bloody hot. We want the thinnest cloth we can get. So we had the trousers made as baggy as we could at the top. But we didn't want them flapping around the bottom, so we had them take them at the bottom. And there's a zoot suit trouser. So right, that okay. was a creation because of fashion. Because of need, I should say.
Necessity, yeah. That's fascinating. Did you... So when people come in and ask for a bespoke suit now, maybe it is for a wedding or maybe it is for some other personal event, is there something that you're noticing within trends now that people are asking for that they weren't do, say, 10, 20 years ago?
I think people want a lighter weight fabric now than what it was. Because we're talking about fabrics, obviously, that's very important because the fabrics have changed over that period of time because you get into lightweight merino wools rather than English worsted. So people don't want heavy stuff because they don't wear as much. Right. You get a few people come in want a heavy suit, so they're going to bet. The guy that's going to wear a suit, he has two suits in a wardrobe, and he's going to alternate them and go on the train going to, say, from where we are in the suburbs out here in Bedfordshire, closer, not far from Milton Keynes, and people are travelling to the West End or going into the city. They'll want to have a very heavy cloth so it lasts, but there's very few people are doing that now, so the fabrics are much, much lighter. So, yes, they want a lighter weight cloth. And then most of them, I tell you what the best thing has happened, and it really has been good, is that a lot of people, the younger people, come in and they bring out their phones.
Yeah.
And they say, I'm looking for something like this.
And who are they looking for? Is it kind of Peaky Blinders, James Bond? Or?
James Bond, yeah, you get a bit of that, definitely. And we all know why, because, the way it's been done over the years, although recently Daniel Craig's are far too tight and far too small. I think they're just trying to make him look like he's a bigger, harder man like they did with the Craze.
Right.
Because obviously, you go back to the Craze, they had their jackets made with big, wide shoulders, narrow lapels clipped into the hips so they look harder. Mm-hmm. But yeah, things like that and the influence. I mean, and obviously, talking about myself and influence and who's influenced me, say, for instance. So I came up through the 60s, and the one guy that changed things in Savaro at the time, he wasn't liked by the establishment, you might say, was Tommy Nutton.
Who did Kilgore and Stanbury himself, right? He was there for a while.
No. Tommy Nutter was a front man, couldn't sew a button on. Yep. His cutter, who I have the greatest admiration for, still alive, has his own business still now, is Edward Sexton. So he's now in Knightsbridge area rather than Savaro. Edward's a couple of years older than me, cracking cutter. But he did the suit. So if you go back to the Ringo Starr, who just died, if you look at some of the suits he had, there was a lovely big Prince of Wales check. So Tommy was the designer, Edward was the cutter. And they revolutionised Savaro, because at that time, at the late 60s, most of the shops didn't have a shop window. There wasn't a suit in the window. There's normally a few lengths of cloth laying there covered in dust. And that's the way it was. And they brought them into a new look. So that look, and they did quite a square shoulder rather than a sloping shoulder and a natural shoulder. If you look at a Savaro, Taylors, Anderson, a Shepherd, who are Taylors are very good repute, high repute, world renowned. But they do a lovely soft natural shoulder line, if that's what you want. We've always tended to do a slightly squarer shoulder line. I like a slightly sharper looking suit. I like to slim. I've never had a customer come in say, can you make me look fat? I'll tell you that. That's a fact. So everybody wants to be looking slimmer.
Nice. Did you get a chance to meet Tommy by any chance?
I met him a couple of times, but he died many years ago. He was gay. He died from AIDS. He died a long, long while ago. But yeah, I met him up in the West End on a couple of things and a couple of events, just casually saying hello to him, but I didn't know him very well. I had met Edward Sexton once, because I used to be the president of the Federation of Merchant Tailors, so that was our governing body. That was back in 1988-89, I was the 99th national president of the Federation, so I met most of the Savaro people then.
Right.
Because I joined the National Council to find out what was going on with the trade and with apprenticeships and what was happening. Because there was a fabulous title, of course, called the Tailor and Cutter, one of the most famous titles in the world, has been defunct for many, many years. Which Continest owns still the title, but it never comes out. I did the last one of those when I was president. I brought out three issues in 1988.
Why aren't they reviving that? We should get a petition going and get over to Condé Nast. Well, sitting on that.
They're sitting on the title. We managed to borrow the title as a Federation of Merchant Tailors, which is basically the tailors themselves. Nothing to do with the woolen merchants, just us and the governing body of ourselves. We dealt with the wages and what they call the London Log and what you're paying the staff and things like that. It's in the National Wages Council for that to sort out the tailors. So I did a bit of that for 4 or 5 years. And that's when I met a lot of the guys from the West End and a lot of the Savaro people and went to the national conferences as we used to have. It folded, I think. We got amalgamated back in the 90s, later in the 90s. It doesn't exist now. But it does, but it doesn't exist. Forget it. In fact, The only thing that really is an organisation really is the charitable side of it. And, of course, for the Golden Shears Award for the apprenticeships and things like that they do now at Merchant Tailors Hall. That's still going now, which is a good thing.
Okay, yeah, that should be supported. Yeah, the Tommy Natter story is quite a wild one, because he was he was doing a lot of the suits for Elton John. I know I'm telling you stuff that you already know, but that's kind of how I learned about Tommy Natter and how he inspired the likes of Tom Ford, so current designers even now. Ford said that the first thing I heard about Tommy Natter was there was a guy who couldn't get into a club and he decided to dive into the River Thames. So that was like how we heard of Tommy Natter.
Yeah, yeah.
He was a bit of a wild guy.
He was a wild guy. He was 50 years ahead of his time. But he wasn't liked in Savaro. They really didn't like him and what he did. Without being homophobic about this, I think there was a little bit of that, unfortunately, at that time as well. But he was flamboyant. It was lots of stuff. Savaro was like a little, quiet little club. And of course, a lot of the tailors, you couldn't walk in the door. You had to be introduced by another customer to get into the shop to actually have a suit made. That's how it used to be.
Right.
They bloody like to have some customers now with the problem of and not being able to get everybody from America, of course. They can't travel.
How does that work for you, Jeff, now? I mean, can we just talk about anything that's going on with the pandemic and COVID and lockdown? Are you able to see your customers personally?
I mean, now it's fine. We couldn't, obviously. When we opened in April, on April the 12th, I think it was, we'd been shut as a shop for 8 months of the previous 13 months. Not bloody funny. Government helped us out with the furlough so I could furlough my family. I couldn't get money myself, or my wife was apparently been out too much bloody money the year before. That's our fault, but we can survive. It's not the end of the world. And the government were very helpful. And then since then, it's been fantastic for us, because we are able to see customers. The thing about woven than itself, and here is a private car park at the back of the shop. Generally, most men do not like going around shops. That's obviously a generalization, but most of them don't like going shopping. So to come to a place like us, park the car, get sorted out, get kitted out, get advised. Very often they come the first time with their wives or their partners, and then after the wives and partners have been there, see what we do and how we look after them, and they don't have to worry about it, then the guys will come on their own. But they'll come here, they can go for a lunch somewhere, they go to a game of golf, go to a safari park. So it's a bit of a day trip, as you might say. And we have a good social media thing going on because of my future daughter-in-law pushing stuff out all the time, and we have a good website, as you've mentioned already. And people travel to us from all over the country. It's quite amazing how far people come. It really is. From people from Somerset, from people, lots of people south of the river, a lot of people from Hampshire, two or three people from Brighton, and from that area, from that area, Essex, from the Midlands. Don't get people from the Midlands north. I think most of those, there's a lot of history in the Midlands with tailoring. They've got their own tailors up there. But people travel to us from a long way.
Right. And can we talk a little bit about your client list as well on the website? So perhaps some of your favourite clients that people would have heard of?
You have to be, I'll tell you one thing, Pete, you have to be very, very careful when you promote celebrities and footballers or Formula One drivers. Because if you promote it too much, it tends to scare Mr. Average away, who thinks we won't be interested in serving him for one suit, and he doesn't think he can probably afford to come. So you have to be careful. In fact, I never used to publicise it, but my son said, come on, Dad, everybody loves these stories of yours and all your old customers. So the very first real celebrity I had was Eric Morgan, obviously Morgan Morris. And Eric lived in Harkenden. He was recommended to me. And he called me round to make him a couple of suits. He'd been going to all the tailors in Savile Row, but he'd heard about me. And I made him a couple of suits. At that time, I had my shop in Luton. And I was just about to open the shop in Dunsmore. He was a lovely man, and he was always funny. He couldn't stop the poor fellow. I think that's why the poor fellow died. He asked me how business was. I said, I'm opening up the shop in Dunsmore. I went back with the suits after the second fittings, and the suits were fine. He said, how's it going with your new shop? I said, well, it's nearly ready. He said, you wouldn't care to open it for me, Mr. Morgan, would you? And he looked at me and he said, I don't do that sort of thing. I said, I know you don't. I said, but I thought I'd ask. He said, you're a cheeky little bugger, aren't you? Let me give you some thought. And he did. Fair play to him. He came and opened my shop.
Offered
to send the driver. He said, no, I've got a driver. I'll come and help you. And he did. In today, if he did that now with social media and everything, it'd be fantastic. Right. So Eric was the first real celebrity, but the best advert for me, certainly through the 80s, was Bob Monkhouse. So I made everything for Bob Monkhouse from the mid to late 80s till he died in 2003, Christmas time 2004. He had a very good tailor before me called Robbie Stanford. I don't think Robbie's still alive. But Robbie was getting old. Bob needed some suits made, and unfortunately he couldn't make them in time. He lived near to where I am here in Bedfordshire. Made contact with me. We had to do a couple of suits off the peg from our collections off the peg, as it was in those shops at that time in Dunstable. And I knocked him into shape for him, and I said to him, I said, come on in, you're meeting me now, why don't you let me make you something and see what you think? So I then made him a blazer. He was happy. And then a little while later, I got called round. Six suits got to be made. Three were going to be made by Robbie. I'm going to make the other three. So I got in there, made those ones, and then the following time, I got called round six suits, and I made them all.
Wow.
And he was a wonderful advert because he was immaculate. I mean, forget what he was like with comedy. He was the king. He was incredible, that man. Laura, he got tickets for Laura and I to go and see the audience in Bob Monkhouse on the telly when they did that. And we were the only people in the audience that were not TV stars, celebrities or film stars and people like that. He was wonderful. And then we've done lots of other people. Daniel Ricciardo, obviously Formula One. We've made for lots of footballers in the past. My son, Scott, looks after one of my footballers now. He's an ex-England footballer. I won't say his name, but I don't know, but he's an ex-England footballer. He's just retired, and he used to play for Man City. He's now playing for Liverpool.
I can say the name, though, can't I, Jeff?
You can say what you want to say.
I'm a Liverpool fan, so I'm a
well, you know, my favourite. It's James Milner. And so, I mean, James doesn't mind us saying, I'm sure he doesn't mind me saying that he shocks of us. But Scott, my eldest son, looks after him and also with his wife, partner, Amy, as well. So we do the ladies' tailing side as well. So there's been quite a few celebrities over the years and funny people. I did Matthew Kelly. One thing that was really funny, it's something I've always been proud of, funny enough. Back in, Gordon Bennett, how far was it? Back in the late 90s, I think, on Saturday night on television. You've got to remember now, I'm a provincial tailor. Forget all Savaro. Yeah, I've worked up there and I've got the Federation of Merchant Tailors credentials, all this sort of stuff. But I'm a provincial tailor. And on Saturday night, I had my suits on both sides.
That's fantastic.
On television. So I had the National Lottery with Bob Mountcastle and Eamon Holmes. And on the other side, I had Matthew Kelly doing Stars and the Rise. So my suits are on both sides on prime television. And that,
I got a kick out of it.
Oh, really? Yeah, we're just a small family business. We're not a bloody big company like some of the people up in the row, you know. But I really, really got chuffed with seeing them on there like that.
But they looked, I mean, like, I guess this is kind of like my time of growing up. I mean, growing up now, you got infinite amount of choices. Even on your phone, you can just watch about 100 channels at once. But back in those days, it was four channels. And that's basically what you had on. You might not have even been liking what you were watching, but that was what
you had no choice.
Right? So, I mean, it would be like for us, it would be, I mean, Parkinson, for example. I mean, looking back on it now, I wasn't that fussed about Parkinson. I'd love to see Parkinson on TV or interviewing.
Yeah.
And he always...
Being the Yorkshireman man he is, and he's actually admitted this for a couple of things recently, I've noticed in the press that he wasn't politically correct at the time. But actually at the time, he was perfectly okay. But now we're looking back on it, some of the things he said and the way he talked to people, particularly ladies, was one famous one that they didn't get on at all. But he was... I loved Parkinson. The first time I ever heard or saw Billy Connolly was on Parkinson. We were having dinner with some friends and I could hear this raucous laughter from the table. We weren't really watching it, it's on. Who the bloody hell is this? And it was the big Ian. I mean, he was hilarious.
Yeah.
I mean, television-wise, I mean, I've managed to get on telly a couple of times. We are the only tailors that ever got on the clothes show, ever.
Wow. That's
so
amazing.
We got on, I was making suits for a little Barry McGuigan, the world champion boxer as he was at the time.
Yeah.
Barry a little while ago at Eamon Holmes' 60th, lovely little fella. And the BBC decided they wanted to run a story on the making of Barry McGuigan suits. So I got Jeff Banks interviewing me for like 4.5 minutes, prime television at that time on a Sunday night, before Country File, which had the clothes show on.
Uh-huh.
And to my knowledge, there's never been another tailor on there. So that was great publicity. But again, no internet, you see.
Right, yeah.
No
yeah.
internet. So people have got to try and find you.
I say this about a tailor I'm sure you're familiar with, Jeff, Doug Hayward.
Dougie made the stars. You know, I've made for a few people. Dougie was in a different league to me.
But I spoke to Doug Hayward's daughter and ex-wife a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
And I said, look, had social media been around those days, I think he probably would have got a lot of the recognition that he felt he may have deserved. I mean, he got the client list. Let's not joke about that. But if that was of today, then you'd be seeing Doug Hayward's name in lights in every column, right?
Huge. In fact, because he was quality, he was a great tailor. I never met Dougie, but I did know well of him. If that was coming out now, he wouldn't be able to cover the business.
Yeah.
You know, the Google and the internet is a wonderful thing, but when you're like us in a small family business, you know, when I've dealt PR companies of a process, come on, you've got such a wonderful story, you've got a wonderful bloody unique selling proposition using an awful bloody Americanism, but you have got the story going on, you cut the suits on the premises, you've got all this stuff going on. And they say, oh, we've got to get it out there. And I said, well, how much more business do you need? I said, well, I don't need a lot more business. So I couldn't cope with it anyway. And they get stunned. And the other thing they get stunned with is the age group. They sort of say, well, what's your target audience? They say, well, I've got customers in their 20s and customers in their 90s. I've just made two suits for one of my old customers for his 90th birthday. And he only wanted one, but he decided to have two because he could afford to do what he wants. And I'll tell you what was funny, Pete. You know, this is dealing with the public now, talking about dealing with the public. It's been wonderful. 97-98% of the time dealing with the public, one or two is always going to be a problem, but we had so much fun with our customers. But this guy, so he spends a few bob with me, and two full bespoke suits, three pieces, so it's over £8,000. And so I said, well, you want to leave his couple of grand deposit? And he looked around at me. I've been making his clothes for over 40 years, no names here, by the way. I will not mention customers' names, that's different. He looked around at me and said, have I not taught you anything, Jeff, in 40 years you make my suits? He said, I'm bloody 19, actually. Take the lot up front. So we agreed and he wrote a check out for 5,000. He's old school, check, no car, wrote a check out for 5,000.
Oh, that's sweet.
But that's it. So dealing with the public has been wonderful.
That's
and I think what people like about our place, you know, where you can you can see things going on, you can see the cutting, you can actually see it happening. Where obviously when you've got the meter measures, I don't know if you want to touch on the differential so people can understand the difference between a factory made tailored garment and a handmade.
So
the word bespoke obviously gets misconstrued. It's bespoken for, it's made to order. So anybody making a suit in a factory anywhere in the world, doesn't matter where it's been made, we use international firms, like Portugal, some places, Mauritius, all over the place to make clothes. There's nowhere in England, if there was, I'd use them. There was, but they've all gone. So when you actually measure somebody and you then send it away and have it factory made, that we describe as a made to measure suit. And we call it as black label. A bespoke suit to us is when you cut it and fit it on the premises and you have it hand tailored by either on the premises when we can make it, and when ones we don't make, we've got other tailors that work for us, that work for some of the people in several as well, the outworkers of the craft industry, where trouser makers, coat makers, waistcoat makers will actually finish and hand sew the garments off. And they're totally different, and there's a totally different price. It's over double to have it done by hand. Same cloth, same material. Mm. The time in serving at the beginning is the same. The time and the care that we take in sorting out the styling. And the way they work, some people come in and they say, I want your entry level, your black label. Is that when you just get like a ready-to-wear suit and you change it to fit me? So no. A made-to-measure suit is still going to be individually cut for you in the choice of your cloth with the style of the lining. Some of the intricacies that we do on ours, the five-button cuff is actually put into the factories now. And so you say it's still made to measure for you. And strictly speaking, anybody can say it's still a bespoke suit because it is. Mm-hmm. It's using the word for what it actually says it is. But a proper bespoke suit, I mentioned earlier in the discussion with you, Pete, about the Federation of Merchant Tailors that obviously I got involved in back in the 80s and was president of. The criteria to be a member of the Federation of Merchant Tailors then was you had to cut and you had to fit them on the premises. You couldn't say they had to be made on the premises because you had outworkers at that time all the way around Soho, around London. They're still there, but nothing like they used to be. And because of a change in planning laws back in the 80s, that's another story you may not have time for now, but the government changed the planning laws and suddenly the rents quadrupled. So therefore the tailors had to start going working from home, and that's made it hard to get apprenticeships to come in because you couldn't send them to somebody's house to learn.
Right.
So the difference, there is a difference. And when you get a hand cut, your canvases inside, what do you know about canvases yourself? About a jacket being canvassed or half canvassed or fused? What do you know?
So it has to be either lined or fused. It kind of adds to the weight, and that's can either move and shift up and down depending whether it's actually sewn in or floating, I suppose.
Well, not quite right. Shall I
edge my go.
but you see, it's interesting because you're loosely in the fashion industry as such, and people don't know, they don't understand. So fusing the canvas on the front of the cloth, on the front of the jacket once it's been cut, means that it's bonded on the canvas. So when you have a suit, you've got your cloth, you've got your canvas, and then you've got your lining. So the canvas is in between. You don't see it, but it's in between. And fusing it on the front of the cloth has been going on for 60, 70 years. When it first came out, they were stiff as a board. They were awful. They're much better now. But it's stuck on, it's done in seconds, it's done in factories and these magic machines that roll it on and put it on. It doesn't come off and it stays on, if it's put on properly, by the way. And if we do a handmade suit, then the canvas is put in by hand and it's sewn in by hand. And you can shape the canvas. It's normally out of horsehair, so it's not always natural. One of my customers came to me once and said, I don't want anything to do with the twins, Jeff. And I thought, what the bloody... The eccentric bespoke customers, I have to tell you, I don't know what he's talking about. What twins? What twins are you talking about? He said, Polly and Esther. Polyester. So that was his little joke. So the canvases are put in by hand and they're shaped. Now, the made-to-measure suits, well, these are wear suits as well, and the made-to-measure suits cannot put the they can do the cutting, but they can't do the craft tailoring of shape. Now, if I've got somebody who's got a full chest, been working out or ex-military, you've got a round and you've got a flat piece of cloth. So yeah. You mould it, you cut it as best you can, and then you shrink it and you shape it with the canvases to build the chest up with the chest piece. The chest piece is where it says it is, above the breast line and up, and that's all hand padded. You know, customers asked me many years ago, how many stitches are there in a jacket? You know, I'll tell you what, I ain't got a bloody clue. So we asked one of our coat makers, do us a favour, give us a bit of an idea. And he said, well, it depends on how big the jacket is, but it's between 4,000 and 5,000 hand stitches per jacket.
Wow.
The buttonholes, when the buttonholes are done by hand, each buttonhole is 100 stitches. So if, like with me, with a 5-button cuff, 2 front buttons and a flower hole, it's 1,300 stitches just on the buttonholes.
Right.
But it's still got to be cut properly and it's still got to fit. But there's a difference between the feel of a handcraft made suit and the hardest thing as a salesman, as I have been all my life, besides being a tailor's cutter, is trying to explain to people what does it feel like. The only way you're going to find out is have one. And yeah. That's obviously going to cost you a few bucks.
Jeff, I had a time in the tailor's. I was just front of house. I wasn't doing anything, cutting or anything. And the guy that I was working for was kind of a rock and roll star in terms of, well, he thought he was. He thought he was a big name. And he'd gotten to a stage where he actually just thought, I don't want to be doing anything front of house, no fittings.
Yeah.
He just wants to basically reap the rewards of his name and the tailoring house and not really have anything to do with the customers. Yeah. It sounds like with you, it's kind of the opposite, that you actually love having that time with the customers and finding out what they're like.
Oh, right? Everybody that meets me, particularly now I'm 70, just only a few weeks ago, don't like being 70, but I am. And everybody that meets me said, you're still enthusiastic. It's unbelievable you're enthusiastic. I said, look, don't get me wrong. I like a few gin and tonics or rum and coke, so I want to earn a few bob, but I love my trade. I mean, damn it all. I've told you when I started, when I was 15 years old, it's now 55 years. Every day of my life, I've done this. Damn it, you've got to like it, haven't you? I don't have to work now, Pete. I don't really have to work. But I want to work. I love serving the customers. I love when you get a guy coming in where the wife's brought him in because it's his daughter's wedding. This is a classic case where a guy's middle-aged and he's got the dreaded middle-age spread, or what we commonly call the lower chest. So he's got the tum. And he doesn't want to be in my shop because he knows it's going to cost him a few bob. He'd rather be at the football, rugby, or playing golf or doing something else. And he doesn't want to be there. And you can almost see that the other half is dragging him in. And I love it when they come in because I think, right, I'm going to knock your bloody eyes out. I'm going to make you look slimmer. Uh-huh. And when you go to that wedding, people are going to say, how much weight have you lost? Your suit looks fantastic. And I do it. And they tell you, 6 months later, 9 months later, that guy will come back in and he'll say, you knew I was coming back in, didn't you? So I said, yeah, I know what you're coming back in for. He said, you can't wear none of the other clothes now, can you? So I said, no, you bastard. He's done everything. Thought it fit. I just want a nice casual jacket now. And they do often intimate I never had a father because they say, you bloody knew I'd be back. But it's like everything in life. Nice restaurants, nice cars, nice holidays, the good things in life. Once you've tasted, bloody hard to go back.
Yeah.
Bloody hard to go back.
Jeff, I feel like I could talk to you for hours.
My family would tell you that you could.
Well, listen, it's been wonderful hearing all of those stories, and especially listening to the passion for, you know, bespoke suits and still going on with you and flying the flag like you have been for so many years.
Thank you.
I got to ask, has there been any, outside of the client list that you had, any people that you've been influenced by with style in terms of screen actors, maybe like a Roger Moore or a Cary Grant, are the people that look at and go, well.
Oh, Sean Connery, end of story. end of story. I mean, Daniel Craig, no, because the suits are too small and he's busting out of all over the place. Sean Connery, and you mentioned Dougie Hayward and people like that. When you go back to that look and those people, that influenced me hugely. I love Steve McQueen, the way he looked. I like the Rat Pack. I love Sinatra and those boys. And the way I was lucky enough to see Sammy Davis live. We actually saw, it was a fantastic show. We saw Sammy Davis, Frank Sinatra and Liza Minnelli in a show called The Main Event back in the 80s at the Albert Hall. And Sinatra, just lovely suit, beautifully cut. Sammy Davis, same, those days, mohair suits and things like this. Classy, absolutely wonderful. Modern people, anybody? One I'd have to put my hands up to would probably be Beckham, with David Beckham.
Okay.
Never tailored for him. Look, would have loved to have done. I think what he's done to make men look smart is helpful because basically at the moment, men are so scruffy. How women ever let men go out to a restaurant when the girls have done their hair, they've got a dress on or something, and the guy goes out with a scruffy pair of jeans on, a scruffy pair of trainers, and a bunny baggy sheep T-shirt. How they let them do it. And these people have money.
I'm with you. I actually blame the women more than I blame the men. So
they let them get away with it.
I had a guy, I put this as well to my girlfriend the other day. I said, I equate it to a guy that turns up to work stinking, right? I've worked construction pretty much all my life.
Yeah, okay.
Dude turns up and he's absolutely honking, like real bad.
Yeah.
I say, how can the woman let him leave the house like that? Because it's a reputation. It's all kind of coming back. It reflects.
It's a good analogy because it drives me around. And when I see people on television that are badly dressed, you know, I said earlier, whether you put this into the podcast, because obviously we've had a long chat tonight, which is normal with me, the way that you fit the armholes, so the armholes high so the jacket doesn't move and it doesn't come up in it. I look at newscasters, people sitting on television wearing a suit and the jacket's coming up, hitting them in the back of the head. And I'm thinking, that's off the peg, for Christ's sake. Go and get yourself a bloody tailor suit. Not with me, yes, come and give me some money, by all means, but go to a proper tailor and get the suit to fit you properly. Yeah. The fashion now for men is the worst it's ever been. And you know the worst thing about it is, you look at the Italians and see them dressed down. Boy, can they dress down. They can still, they can walk around with chinos, with turn-ups on, with the trousers 3 inches too short, with brogues on and no socks, and the buggers still somehow look cool. The English guy does it, he looks like a pile of crap.
It does.
Drives me around the twist. I see it all the time. I get so frustrated with it. But there you are. You have to learn to live with it, don't you?
Well, you do the chinos, you do the shirts,
we can make people dress down in style, believe me, because that's... Yep. You know, I had when it first started, Dress Down was a Dress Down Friday, started in America. Came over here, then we'll have Dress Down every day, no criteria of what you got to wear. I just made this lovely old boy, very conservative man, in the professions, either accountant or solicitor. Just made him 3 bespoke suits, and I get a panic phone call from him one morning. Mr. Suster, he said, I've got a problem. So what's the matter? I thought he'd tell me wrong with the suits. He said, no, I've got a problem. Our company are going to dressing down. What's this dressing down? I said, well, you have to be more casual. But what do I wear? I said, well, you'll have to come back in and see me. I'll make you a couple of jackets and some trousers, which is what I did. But he typifies a man who's going to work, and the suit was a uniform. In the morning, he didn't have to think, what jacket do I put with this pair of chino? He just put the navy pinstripe suit on, the grey pinstripe suit, and that white shirt on that tie. That's his only choice. He hadn't got time to muck about with it. But with people dressing down, it's been going on for 30 years now, and it's abysmal. I just hate it with vengeance. I'm looking forward also, Pete, to when this awful fashion of these too skinnier trousers, as they were called, as I said earlier, drain pipes, like 15-inch, 14-inch bottoms with people size 12 feet, for Christ's sake. What the hell do they look like? And I'm looking forward to the fashion, which I do believe is beginning to come, where pleats are coming back into the trousers again, higher rise, and therefore the bottom will go wider. Actually, we'd probably make less money because I need more cloth for that, by the way, because it's actually cutting drain pipes. You don't need so much material. But in all seriousness, I'd be happy if you can get the fashion coming back with a proper pair of trousers cut.
I'm seeing it coming back. I mean, I don't know if it's just because of the people that I follow or gravitate towards.
We've had some young lads in. There's a guy came in to get the suit made for the daughter's wedding, and the two younger sons who were not having suits made because they were only about 14 or 15, quite stylish, these boys, they're a bit out there. And they're talking to their father, and the father said, I'm going to have flat-fronted trousers. The boy said, Dad, you should have pleats. And he said, I used to wear pleats. He said, Dad, you should be wearing pleats. They're coming back. First time I've heard that in my shop, so it's going to happen. Very simple, Pete. You know why that happens, why it changes? When you find out as a lad, and you're quite stylish with your late teens, early 20s or whatever, and you find out that your father is wearing the same style as you, then you think, shit, I can't wear that anymore. I've got to go and get something else and make it and have a different style because I can't wear the same garment as what my father is.
Right.
That is how fashion changes. Trust me.
That's how it changed between the 50s and 60s, right?
Because all the way through.
The young started to have a bit of disposable income. They didn't want to be wearing the same heavier cloth as their dad. Yeah.
It all changed. Although traditionally, Savile Row, you used to have a lot of the fathers would introduce their son and bring their son into the same tailor. Old school, public school, old school, that stuff, that was always, you'd go to your same tailor as your father. But for the general public, with due respect, they rebelled. The 60s was the rebellion. I mean, God, the fashions have changed for the 60s. And I tell these young kids now that come in about wearing these trousers and having the jackets too short up, the bum freezes, as I said earlier. And I say to them, you know, you've got to be careful not to get caught in a fashion, in an extremity of fashion. And here is somebody saying that, talk about kettle black. I got married in 1972 to my wife, Laura, 49 years this year. God knows how she's put up with me. And I was wearing 24-inch wide flares with 2.5-inch turns, platform sole shoes. My hair was down to my shoulders. My lapels were cut very wide and had a braided edge around them, which is actually copied off what Tommy Nutter did for Ringo Starr, because I love what he did then. So, and actually, the lapels were wider than the bloody shoulders. And if it had been a windy day, I'd have bloody took off in that. When my son saw those pictures when they were old enough to understand, I said, what made you wear that, Dad? So there's me trying to tell a kid, don't do it, don't do it. But I did it myself.
The story I love best about Tommy Nutt's lapels is that you'd have to walk out the door sideways so that you
sideways can, that's what they used to say. Yeah, he was 5-inch lapels, but he had a very concave, that's a concave shaped shoulder that went up in the air, which actually was Edward's sex. Edward was the cutter. Tommy obviously, unfortunately, lost the business a couple of times. In fact, he also lost the use of his name, to be able to use his name to trade as, because it was just Nutters and things like that. But Edward was the man. He was the cutter. Tommy was the inspiration for Styles and getting all the PR. God knows what Tommy Nutter would be doing now with social media and things. he would be forget David Beckham, Tommy Nutter would be whoa, way up there.
Wow.
Highest respect for the man, and the fact he was gay and he died from AIDS was a tragedy. And the way he was treated, I won't say anymore because I know a lot of things, the way he was treated and the way he was spoken about in Savile Row by some of the old school people there because he was gay and the way he was horrendous.
It's terrible.
Honestly, horrendous.
Tricky times. Hey, Jeff, I've got another random question for you.
Go on.
Tommy Nutter did the suits for the Abbey Road LP apart from George Harrison, right? And yeah. I've often wondered, what was George wearing, as in who cut for George?
Well, it was a bit different, wasn't it? Big white. Well, because it's the fashions again then, isn't it?
Right.
But it depends whether George was a character in himself, let's be serious. Did he instigate his tailor to cut that look, or did the tailor do it for him? That's the question you need to find out.
Chicken and egg. Well, I've...
Bespoke tailors, I have people that come into me and want something I do not think is right for them. Now, the word bespoke is what it says. It's bespoken for. They're telling me what I've got to make them. Yeah. I will endeavour to do everything I can to educate the customer and explain to them they shouldn't have that. In fact, I wish my mates had told me not to have my bloody wedding suit, but that's another story. but you have to think, actually, did he ask for it? I do get people who come in and I say, look, in my professional opinion, that's not the right style for you. However, you're paying. If you want me to do it, I'll do it. And that's the other thing we haven't touched on. I could talk all night, as you just found out. That the way that people come in the old days, there'd be so many tailors. You'd go to a tailor for his cut. I mean, Dougie Hayward used to have a lovely cut for suits, very Savile Row. And you'd go for a certain tailor. So you'd go to the West End for the tailored fitted look, slightly flared. Or you'd go to the East End of London for what they used to call a semi-drape, which was a big wide shoulder, slim lapel. The gangster look, the craze look. And you would go to a tailor's for his cut. Right. Not about price, you'd go for his cut.
Mm.
We now, as a family, we have to cut every cut there is because there aren't enough tailors. So everybody comes to us and says, I want that look, I want this look. I love it. When I get that old book out, The Sharp Suits, there's a fabulous picture in there taken from the Gatsby with Redford in it. And he's got a lovely square-fronted double-breasted waistcoat on. And I've made that several times in a pinstripe suit, not now recently, but in the past. And people look, I love that look. It's very 1940s gangster look on that. So American look, as it happens. And it stimulates them. They come in, they don't necessarily want to copy everybody else. What's the point of coming to me as a tailor and copying with respect what Giorgio Armani happens to be putting out that year? You'll come to us and create your own fashion, particularly for your own size and your own lifestyle.
Yeah. I was wondering also, is that the kind of why we were going to see a return to, say, like the classic style, the pleats, the higher rise? Because when you kind of go, when you do a lot of secular fashion, you kind of go through 70s and the flares and the 80s and the power suits, whatnot, you kind of look back and go, well, why was Sean Connery looking so damn good against an Aston Martin? Because, well, it was a very classic, simple, no bells and whistles.
I get customers that come in and, you'll change. But I would be wearing my jacket now. I'm still in inches, obviously. I'd be wearing my jacket now 3/4 inch shorter than what I wore 10 years ago.
So,
But that's all. Because I'm going with a fashion where the jacket's a bit short. I put one of my old suits on that I made 10 years ago, put it on. I said, bloody hell, that after it bomb. And, of course, what you do, you then look at it. Everybody's eyes get used to seeing everything on telly.
Yeah.
You see Dermot O'Leary in the suits and he's on X Factor. I mean, a nicely made shirt. I don't know who his tailor is, but nicely made suits and all the rest of it. But the jackets are too short and they're too tight. But everybody gets used to that silhouette.
Yeah.
And when they come in and you make the right thing for them, Then they said, no, that's too long. I said, no, actually, that's right. What you've been looking at is too short. But yeah. that's where you have to make sure before you mate for somebody that you're on the same wavelength. But we always put, if we do our made-to-measure suit, where it's factory, we have, my block has been digitized and put into the factory, so it's exclusive to us. So you can't get that from anywhere else. So I've had master models made in a 36 chest to a 54 chest, three piece and everything. In fact, the trousers have all been tapered now, they're much slimmer now. So you put on the nearest ready-to-wear size, and that's how you make them work. So they put on. So we ask them to bring something in with them. That's the biggest thing you can do. Bring something in they're used to wearing, because people could be wearing their sleeves for so long.
Right. Yeah.
When you make them the correct length, they'll say, "Oh, they're too short." So no. Where do you normally wear them then? So we always tell people first time they come into us, bring something in. I don't care how old it is. I don't care if it's tatty. Bring it in. I want to see what you used to wear. And then we copy everything that we agree is correct and change everything we know that's wrong. And that's how it works. You don't get the problems there. But you don't have the luxury of a bespoke fitting with a made-to-measure, a factory-made suit. It's cut straight to finish, except for the leg length. You tweak it when it comes in the shop if you need to find a little detail. But you don't have the luxury of a bespoke fitting or having a couple of fittings to the customer before you finish it.
Yeah.
That's how it works. And it does with the shirts as well. We've got to touch on that. Same thing with shirts. We have sample sizes in, and everybody tries on a sample size. When we go to our shirt makers, because we're not making them, we're not shirt makers, we give direct measurements of the shirts, several, across the shoulder width itself, end-to-end shoulders, the depth of the armhole, the chest measurement, the waist, the hip, the length of the front, the length of the back, the length of the sleeve, the width of the cuff, the width of the elbow. If you measure a shirt that way, off a customer bringing a shirt in that he likes, change one or two little things, how the bloody hell can it be wrong? What do you need fittings for?
Do you offer different cuffs as well?
Yeah. Yep.
But in terms of what is also being asked in the cuff department, are there any kind of eccentrics being asked?
Well, to be honest with you, with the shirts, we've gone through that period of time where we were one of the first, we used a company, one of our manufacturers is out in Singapore, and they do some unbelievable stylings, and you've got different colours inside here, edging down here, and then the ready-to-wear people copied it, and they all went avant-garde with it, and everybody's got fed up with that now. Yeah. So the shirts are calming down. You get a little bit of detail, maybe a different colour button, or the buttons are stitched on in a particular colour. Something more subtle. Definitely the flash side of shirts is old hat now.
Right.
Everybody's worn it. Some people wore his shirts, you look like Mickey Mouse. You know, the people would go over the top. We had one customer of mine who made himself a fortune in finance, and he used to, I won't say his surname, his first name was Martin, and he used to have lots of suits made, and he knew I could do anything. And I had an agreement with him, Pete. I said to him, "So Martin, when I say one word, it means we're stopping. We're not going to put that onto the suit."
Right.
And the word was clown. He said, "Oh, how about if I do that? Do it." I go, "Martin, clown." So, okay, fine.
Right.
I said, "You look like a bloody clown."
Yeah.
And some of the stuff he had done, I said, "I'll tell you what, if you go any further now, I'm not putting my bloody label in."
Do you find it also a little bit strange when the women would have a different opinion to what the guy has? Like, for example, right? I'm wearing a shirt now. We're talking about kind of clown shirts.
Like every time.
But I'm wearing a shirt now that I'm kind of like, well, I don't know. Whatever, I'll get it. But then my girlfriend goes, "This is like the best shirt I've seen you in." And I've still kind of got zero confidence in it. But, you know, there must be when the woman comes in and the guy come in together that she'll have something that you'll go, "Jesus Christ, lady." And
You know what? As a salesman, you sell the woman, you don't sell the man.
Right, yeah.
Because she's the one who'll look at it. And if she don't know what you've done, she'll tell him and you won't come back.
Yeah.
But we don't do it. You do it up front. I look at the guy and say, "Right, okay, I can't take two decisions here. Who's the boss? You've got trousers on, she happens to have got a dress on. But I have a feeling you're going to have to behave yourself." But I've never had a woman ever come into my shop and say, "I want my trousers or my husband to have trousers that are baggy around the bum." they all want a slim, even if they have pleats, they still want them slim at the back. They never want a baggy pair of trousers. They like to see a man's rear. That's not meant to be sexist. All the women I've ever met, they like it nice and tight. They don't like it looking baggy and old man's, as you might say. But yeah, you do sell to the ladies. And I tell you, it sounds a bit BS-y when I tell you this, but it's not, it's true. You sometimes get a guy and he could be 60 years old, but he looks older than me. Well, I'm 70 now, right? So he looks older than me. He's dressing old, his attitudes look old, but she's 60, but she dresses like she's 50.
Uh-huh.
Yeah? Uh-huh. She looks elegant. I think, "Oh, yeah, wow, you know, who's your daughter?" You don't say it in case you're offended, but that's what you think. But they're the same age. So what you do in conversation when you're talking to him, I style him without even telling him to a degree on her.
Right.
Not on him. because I know that she's going to be happy with me making him look younger.
Right, I see. Yeah, yeah.
And that's something you do. So it's, you know, when John Carter, who great cutter as he was when he taught me, you know, one of the first things he taught me, Pete, and it's true, I say to my customers when I talk to them, he told me half of what you fit on a bespoke suit is the mind, the other half is the body.
Right.
A truer word said, because you can have two customers who measure exactly the same height. One would want a loose baggy fitting jacket, put loads of crap inside the pockets. The other one's a peacock and wants to just leave it undone. So two different sizes completely.
Yeah, yeah.
It's what they want. It's what they want to look like, what they want to feel like. And that's what you have to get into their heads as a bespoke tailor. One of my old friends, who was actually the centenary president of the Federation, Robert, still alive. It sounds a bit waffly, but I know where he's coming from. He said, when I cut a suit for a man, it's a portrait in cloth.
Nice. I like that. I've not heard of that.
Yeah, that's what he said. And when he first said it, I thought, oh, Robert, you are full of it. But actually, he is or was very gentle man and a very lovely man. But he said that, and I thought, really, that's a bit waffly. But I mean, after a while, I thought, yeah, okay, I know what he's saying. He meant it. He loved the trade as much as I do.
Do you illustrate and draw as well before cutting? Or
I can sketch. I've got no skills as a in drawing and things like this. I mean, I can cut. Obviously, I cut by hand. I can draw out my trousers. Mm. Use a set square. So when I make a pattern for a pair of trousers or a jacket, all I have is a tape measure, a set square, a piece of chalk and a pencil onto the card, and I draw. I can do that, but yeah, I can sketch out enough. But actually, with the internet now, not such a bad thing, because you can go on there and find any cut and any look you want to, and they come in, oh, I like that sort of look, and then you can talk about that. Yeah. And we've always got, fortunately, we're busy, always got stuff hanging up, and people, we've got, well, my son said when we changed the shop around earlier this year, so Dad, we're getting all the ready-to-wear, and we're going to have more busts and more models or more mannequins, and we're going to make bomber jackets, we're going to make knitwear, and we're going to display them all. So when people come in, it gives them a picture.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's what you've always done in selling anyway. When I know my customers are coming in, and they come in, and I leave stuff hanging around because I just know they're going to see it. They're going to touch it. And because they all know I do it, by the way.
Right.
And they walk in and the one brother said, okay, what have you bloody set up in this room today? You've left something out. But that's the banter. We have every single one of our customers on first name terms. Everyone. Savaro, my friends up there, when I told him, I said, what do you mean first names? You call them sir, mister? I said, no, first names. Everyone. 1,500 customers or more we got in the books, and we know their first names and the wives' names and their first names. So we're phone up and the wife answers the phone. You know her name. It's very personal, and it makes them feel special. When I phone people up, when they were working in offices, Pete, I phone somebody up and say, oh, your fitness is going to be ready. Can you come in on Saturday or whatever? And someone told me to pick up the phone and say, oh, who is it? And I said, it's Jeff. It's your tailor on the phone. Say that out loud in front of your friends at work. Oh, it's my tailor on the phone. It sounds good. And they love it. They all laugh. It's my tailor on the phone. Oh, it's my tailor on the phone. Yeah.
Well, nice. Jeff, I mean, you're the... I don't want to blow smoke up your ass, but you'd be the star for many people's eyes. I mean, you said you were in the audience for Bob Monkhouse and you were the only person that wasn't a star, but you look back on that tape now for anyone that'd be interested in knowing who made the suits for Bob Monkhouse. And if the camera panned to you, you wouldn't be the odd one out. It's like, oh, that's the guy that made all those wonderful suits, right? So
Yeah. I'm not a star. I'm a tailor that actually knows how to cut a suit. And I do that. Yeah. I know what you're trying to say, and you're not trying to blow it up me. You know, I understand that. But many people have met me. I've got a customer literally last week met me, and I won't say who he is, but he sold out. He was in business with a very famous gentleman, and they sold out a business for over 100 million. And he'd come up from Surrey to have a suit made, and he stood in my shop after he picked up the suit, and I'm making some jeans now on the casual side. And he said, Jeff, he said, you are very unique. He said, you've got to promote yourself more. I don't know how you can do this. He said, you can't explain what it's like when you meet you and your enthusiasm. You know, and he said, you can't get that. I said, we're going to have a video done, a small video done of me cutting the suit and talking, like I've been talking to you, but not for so bloody long, also. probably for 3 or 4 minutes, so that we can get over the cut. But my boys are the same. My boys, the way they serve people, when I'm upstairs in my cutting room at the shop, very often new customers are coming in, I guarantee you, within 2 or 3 minutes, they're laughing.
Right.
There's laughter going on. And I've had other customers upstairs with me when that's been happening, and they said, "Oh, that's a bit of fun downstairs." I said, "No, it's not fun actually." So the boys have just told the guy the price of the soup. You know, it's the same. It's the same funny every time, but it's part of the banjo pool. But that's important, and the personal service side and the care and attention to detail. It has to be that way. As I said earlier, you don't just do this for the money. Yeah, I mean, I've earned a fee, Bob, and I do all right. And I haven't got to work necessarily now anymore, but I choose to want to work. Well, in fact, the business is so busy, the boys couldn't cut me on own anyway, so we've got to do it whilst we've got it, as they say in any business. You said, like your father's business, when you're busy, you think, well, I want to have a day off. You can't have a day off, you've got to work, take it, particularly after what's happened with COVID. Yeah. And don't forget, I told you I lost my business, I lost everything. I lost 3 houses, I had to start all over again, it was very difficult. So once you've gone through that, you don't muck about. When you've got business, do it.
Do you listen to music or anything like that when you cut?
Yeah, I love my music. I'm a 60s boy, so I'm a bit more on the soul, blues, and that Otis Redding, nice. And that kind of thing from the 60s. It all came in the same era as the Moddy Boys and that sort of stuff. It was that kind of music. And we were very fortunate where we lived here in Luton, and next to us is Dunstable. And there was a fabulous ballroom there where what used to happen when the Talk of the Town was open all those years ago, all the stars used to come over from America, the town, the Motown people, everybody, all the famous people you know. And they used to come and do a gig at the California Ballroom, which is this ballroom in Dunstable, and do that at 8 o'clock for 45 minutes, get in a buddy minibus and go up to the Talk of the Town, get paid twice. Mm-hmm. I saw everybody there. Unbelievable. So that was the music. And I played when I'm cutting it here in my little room here at home. I've got a very old B&O unit here. I've just been, earlier tonight, I've just been listening to a lovely old Sinatra duets one with him.
Nice.
I'm not really been a rock and roll man. When I was a kid, I loved the Beatles. When they first came out, I loved the Stones. In fact, actually, as I've got older, I think I preferred the Stones, but I didn't at the time. Uh-huh. I loved Clapton. I loved Eric Clapton. I loved, but that's blues. You know, the stories of Eric Clapton when he went over to Chicago, and he wanted to play, and he's got Buddy Guy and Elwick King or BB King or whatever in the club, and he said, "I want to play the blues." And they say, "You can't play the blues, you're white." That's what they said. That's what they said. Wow. And then we went to a gig at the Albert Hall, where it was Eric Clapton with Buddy Guy, BB King, and Elwick King. He brought them, it's like 10, 15, 20 years later. So, okay, now you can come on.
you've earned your stripes.
Yeah, you've earned your. No, he knows. So, I love music with feeling. I'm not particularly classical music, but some of that I love. There's a wonderful, so James Brown, you've heard of James Brown.
Yep, yeah, absolutely.
There's a wonderful, if you want to see a fantastic piece of music, go on YouTube. Now, James Brown was known very much for It's a Man's World, it's one of his famous songs, which sounds so much like it's a male chauvinist song, but it's exactly the opposite, because it's a man's world, but it'd be nothing without a woman. Mm. That's what he's saying.
Nice.
But have a look. If you want to see something a bit different, and see him sing it with Pavarotti.
Oh, I don't know.
Pavarotti and James Brown singing It's a Man's World. It is the orchestration is in Paris about a year before James Brown died and a few years before Pavarotti died. I've never seen two genres of music put together. It was a night that he had Pavarotti had different people coming on all night long. Grace Jones had just been on with him, and then James Brown comes on. But It's a Man's World is a wonderful piece of music.
I think I remember seeing in the Pavarotti documentary when he brought in all the unusual artists that you would associate Pavarotti.
I think it was 2012 in Paris, but the audience is massive, the orchestration, the singers. But I remember seeing there were 4 ladies sitting there, backing singers, sitting behind Pavarotti. And he's singing, and James Brown, how you can get Pavarotti singing It's a Man's World with James Brown? These 4 women I've looked at it several times. Their faces, the joy on their faces about what they were hearing from James Brown singing it so soulful and so bluesy, and then Pavarotti with his wonderful operatic voice, and it's the same piece of music. It's just stunning.
It's a weird alchemy, isn't it? It's like when Freddie Mercury, who was who would have been 75 yesterday,
75 today. Yeah, I know. Yeah, what a man he was. I remember we went over to Geneva once. I saw his big statue there for the memorial for him, over by the lake. I mean, they're wonderful. I mean, he was another one before his time again. Same as Jimi Hendrix. So it's that era I come from.
Right.
I mean, and modern stuff, not so much. It's my age, I suppose. I'm 70. You get bored. My boys are brought up with soul music, Tanner wrote down to a degree, but I was more of a soul man. I was more Snacks and Atlantic, Aretha Franklin, James Brown.
Did you see any of these at the Granada? I know my old man saw a lot of acts at the Granada. You mentioned Jimi Hendrix there.
I didn't see Jimi Hendrix. I didn't even see Otis Redding. When Otis Redding got killed, he was only 27, I think. I made a black mohair suit. I mourned him. I made one of my first suits I had was a black kid mohair suit. I made a black suit because Otis died. And I never forget it. And his voice was just so soulful. I mean, these arms of mine and pain in my heart and all these sort of songs like that. I have to have music that has a feeling. That can be classical as well, as it happens, although I'm not deeply into classical. But it has to have a feeling. I mean, I love some of the stuff that you look at Adele when she did her stuff, and Amy Winehouse, you know, when Amy Winehouse came out, it's in them. Yeah. It has to have a feeling. It's not just a bloody song. I mean, it's about their lives, obviously. You know, there's lots of new people.
Yeah.
But I'm a bit stuck in my ways at my age now.
And don't go changing, please.
Yeah, for fashion.
Jeff, I've got a bit of a hard out. I have to get the dog out, but
I heard a barking.
It's been a real treat talking to you tonight, and thanks.
Well,
so much.
Well, you've got plenty to take your bits out of there, Pete, haven't you?
Well, I'll probably just put this all up. I mean, it's been fascinating to me. So I just go, if I'm interested, I just assume everybody else is as well. That's just me.
Yeah, well, there you go. It's good fun. It's been a pleasure talking to you. Appreciate what you're doing, and obviously the connection with the James Bond and all that, the story of that. I think it's wonderful. And it's all about fashion. It's all about clothes. The whole thing about it. And it's lovely. You know, it really is. That's why I've got the pictures in here of bloody Steve McQueen and the Rat Pack. You know, and it's lovely. Oh, yeah, I made for Michael Bublé as well, people like that as well.
Yes, I saw on the client list,
But Michael, I met him purely by chance. You know what you said earlier, you said about Michael Parkinson? Bublé had been on Parkinson. We'd heard a couple of songs, but then we'd heard him suddenly, he was on Parkinson. And then Law and I went up, he did a private little gig at the Catherine Prix on the Monday night after he'd been on Parky. And so we managed to get in on the door, which is well before he became internationally famous. Anyway, we go in there. I won't go through the whole story, but I ended up meeting him because I tried to do a favour for a lady that was sitting with us in Canada who got a lovely picture of Michael with her, but not signed. And she was disabled, as it happened, this lady, and I thought, I'm going to go and find him and get him to sign it. Anyhow, I won't go through the whole story now, but when I left, I'd spoken to him. When I left, I managed to get him to get it signed. When I left my credit card. This is fate for you, Pete, and I believe in fate 100%. I left my credit card behind the bar. We're getting a cab to get the train to come back home to Luton in those days. And I just got around the corner of the cab. Sorry, I ain't paid the bill. Got to go and get my card. So I went back into the hall, into the Catherine Green, not a big place. And I went up to the bar to get my card to actually sign. And Michael was there. Everybody else is gone. There's a few girls about and a few press about talking to him. And he saw me and he came over. And he said, you're the gentleman that asked me to sign for that lady. Just to let you know, I did find the time that I signed it. You didn't know her, did you? I said, no, I just saw her. She had that lovely picture. That was really nice of you. And he's looking at me, and I'm booted and suited, right? So I've got a three-piece on tie. I'm looking as I should do it. And I can see he's looking at my suit. He'd got a suit on, which wasn't that clever. I don't know what it was. And I looked at him. I said, yeah, you're looking at the suit now, aren't you? I said, you could do better, you know. He said, are you a tailor? So I said, yes, I am. And we were just to open up a little shop in New Burlington Street with our friends, Denham and Goddard, Pete and Cookie. And I chatted him up and said about I ought to make something for you to look after you. I said, but you know, you're international, you're going all over the place. He said to me, I love what you're wearing. He said, give me your business card.
Oh yeah.
So I said to him, I don't take business cards out. He said, what do you mean? You've just pitched to me? He said, actually, Michael, I didn't pitch at you, you just come in and have a chat with me. I don't take business cards out. When I'm out to play, I'm out to play and enjoy your music and enjoy music and do that. And I said, you know, I haven't got a card. I'll try and get you on your website. I said, oh, you'll find that hard. I said, never mind, Michael. It's not going to be. He got called back then by his agent to speak to somebody from some press or whatever it was. I go over to pay my bill, and I said to the waiter, I said, have you got a serviette? So they gave me a serviette, and I got a biro pen from them, and I wrote my phone number on it. And I walked over to Michael, said, I haven't got a business card, but I can't be any more personal than that. Ring me if you're interested. He phoned me the next morning.
Nice.
I made his first suit again, black kid mohair, silk mohair. Made him a lovely silk, pure silk shirt. Had that made in Italy for him, and he wore that the first time he did the Albert Hall. I went to see him at the Royal Garden Hotel, and got him looking great. He loved it. We were talking music, And you asked me about music, and I said to him, Michael, I said, I love some of your music. I said, but let me ask you a question. I said, would you ever do Try a Little Tenderness? Mm-hmm. Do you know Try a Little Tenderness?
Sure do.
If you don't matter if you don't. Otis Redding did it, okay? Mm-hmm. So a wonderful bit of soulful music. Now, when I first met my wife, her parents were into big band and jazz. And when I first met my father-in-law, God rest him, he died a few years ago, lovely man, he said to me, he said, what sort of music do you like? So I said, I love Otis Redding. So what sort of tracks? He knew of Otis Redding. He loved his music. I said, I love his tracks, Try a Little Tenderness. He said, yeah, I've got that by Sinatra. He did it first. I had no idea. I said, no, Otis Redding. He said, no. He said, I'm telling you now, I've got it on here. It's on RCA. I've got the LP here.
He's wow.
So I didn't know. So I said to Michael Bublé, I said, Michael, so would you like to do Try a Little Tenderness? He said, that's a great track. And I said to him, I said, yeah, but Michael, which version would you do, Frank Sinatra, or would you like to do Otis Redding? And he said, you do know your music, don't you? So I said, yes, I do. And guess what? On the next CD, it was on, Try a Little Tenderness.
Oh, very honestly, cool. Wow.
But I never held him. I can never keep people like him. You've got to take the dog out. I can never keep people like that because they get international, they get agents, big companies, the likes of the Boss and the Marnies, and this will give them the suits for nothing. I'm not working for nothing, so you can't keep them. Nice speaking to you, Pete.
As you can tell, Jeff.
I've been talking all night, mate.
No, it's been my pleasure. Thanks again.
Welcome. I've got to learn how to turn this bloody thing off now.
But then I'll do it my end. Thanks, Jeff. Thanks.
Cheers, Pete. I'll speak to you. All the best, mate.
How about that? I told you it was going to be a good one. Wow, Jeff, thank you so much for sharing those stories, taking us down memory lane. And I got to say, that's probably one of the best podcasts that we've done. No disrespect to the other 130-odd guests we've had on the show, but boy, I had a great time. Hope you did too. Menswearstyle.co.uk is the place where we'll put over the show notes over there. Good luck to my editor transcribing all that. I'm sure it'll be his pleasure. And you can also find us on the social at Menswear Style for updates on more podcasts, articles on lifestyle, travel and whatnot. Thanks again, Jeff. I can't remember out of all that whether I gave the website out. I think it's just in case. This is SousterandHicks.com is the place you can go, and do go over and find out some more great stories, photos of the clients that he's had there. And I'm just looking at them now, some beautiful ones of Barry McGuigan, Bob Monkhouse. So yeah, it's a great place to hang out, and obviously if you get to speak to Jeff, I'm sure he'll love to tell you some more stories. In the meantime, that is it for me. I hope you've enjoyed this. Until next time.